I was attracted to him. I thought about him in that way, to borrow a phrase from the middle school vernacular, but the actual touch, the realized touch, it was all wrong. Then I found myself worrying I would have to make out with him to get to Amsterdam, which is not the kind of thing you want to be thinking because A, it shouldn't have even been a question whether I wanted to kiss him, and B, kissing someone so that you can get a free trip is perilously close to full-on hooking, and I have to confess that while I did not fancy myself a particularly good person, I never thought my first real sexual action would be prostitutional. But then again, he hadn't tried to kiss me. He'd only touched my face, which is not even sexual. It was not a move designed to elicit arousal, but it was certainly a designed move because Augustus Waters was no improviser. So what had he been trying to convey? And why hadn't I wanted to accept it? At some point, I realized I was Caitlining the encounter, so I decided to text Caitlin and ask for some advice. She called immediately. "I have a boy problem," I said. "Delicious," Caitlin responded. I told her all about it, complete with the awkward face touching, leaving out only Amsterdam and Augustus's name. "You're sure he's hot?" she asked when I was finished. "Pretty sure," I said. "Athletic?" "Yeah, he used to play basketball for North Central." "Wow, how'd you meet him?" "This hideous support group." "Huh," Caitlin said. "Out of curiosity, how many legs does this guy have?" "Like 1.4, I said, smiling. Basketball players were famous in Indiana, and although Caitlin didn't go to North Central, her social connectivity was endless. "Augustus Waters," she said. "Maybe?" "Oh, my God. I've seen him at parties. The things I would do to that boy. I mean, not now that I know you're interested in him, but oh, sweet holy Lord, I would ride that one-legged pony all the way around the corral." "Caitlin," I said. "Sorry, do you think you'd have to be on top?" "Caitlin," I said. "What were we talking about?" "Right, you and Augustus Waters. Maybe, are you gay?" "I don't think so. I mean, I definitely like him." "Does he have ugly hands? Sometimes beautiful people have ugly hands." "No, he has kind of amazing hands." "Hmm," she said. "Hmm," I said. After a second, Caitlin said, "Remember Derek? He broke up with me last week because he'd decided there was something fundamentally incompatible about us deep down, and that we'd only get hurt more if we played it out. He called it preemptive dumping." "So maybe you have this premonition that there is something fundamentally incompatible and you're preempting the preemption." "Hmm," I said. "I'm just thinking out loud here." "Sorry about Derek. Oh, I got over it, darling. It took me a sleeve of Girl Scout Thin Mints and 40 minutes to get over that boy." I laughed. "Well, thanks, Caitlin. In the event you do hook up with him, I expect lascivious details." "But of course," I said. And then Caitlin made a kissy sound into the phone, and I said, "Bye," and she hung up. I realized while listening to Caitlin that I didn't have a premonition of hurting him. I had a postmonition. I pulled out my laptop and looked up Caroline Mathers. The physical similarities were striking. Same steroidally round face, same nose, same approximate overall body shape. But her eyes were dark brown, mine are green. And her complexion was much darker, Italian or something. Thousands of people, literally thousands, had left condolence messages for her. It was an endless scroll of people who missed her, so many that it took me an hour of clicking to get past the "I'm sorry you're dead" wall posts to the "I'm praying for you" wall posts. She'd died a year ago of brain cancer. I was able to click through to some of her pictures. Augustus was in a bunch of the earlier ones, pointing with a thumbs up to the jagged scar across her bald skull, arm in arm at Memorial Hospital's playground, with their backs facing the camera, kissing while Caroline held the camera out so you could only see their noses and closed eyes. The most recent pictures were all of her before, when she was healthy, uploaded post-mortem by friends, a beautiful girl, wide-hipped and curvy, with long, straight, dead-black hair falling over her face. My healthy self looked very little like her healthy self. But our cancer selves might have been sisters. No wonder he'd stared at me the first time he saw me. I kept clicking back to this one wall post, written 2 months ago, 9 months after she died, by one of her friends. "We all miss you so much. It just never ends. It feels like we were all wounded in your battle, Caroline. I miss you. I love you." After a while, Mom and Dad announced it was time for dinner. I shut down the computer and got up, but I couldn't get the wall post out of my mind, and for some reason it made me nervous and unhungry. I kept thinking about my shoulder, which hurt, and also I still had the headache, but maybe only because I'd been thinking about a girl who'd died of brain cancer. I kept telling myself to compartmentalize, to be here now at the circular table. Arguably too large in diameter for three people and definitely too large for two, with this soggy broccoli and a black bean burger that all the ketchup in the world could not adequately moisten. I told myself that imagining a Met in my brain or my shoulder would not affect the invisible reality going on inside of me, and that therefore all such thoughts were wasted moments in a life composed of a definitionally finite set of such moments. I even tried to tell myself to live my best life today. For the longest time, I couldn't figure out why something a stranger had written on the internet to a different and deceased stranger was bothering me so much and making me worry that there was something inside my brain, which really did hurt, although I knew from years of experience that pain is a blunt and non-specific diagnostic instrument. Because there had not been an earthquake in Papua New Guinea that day, my parents were all hyper-focused on me, and so I could not hide this flash flood of anxiety. "Is everything all right?" asked Mom as I ate. "Uh-huh," I said. I took a bite of burger, swallowed, tried to say something that a normal person whose brain was not drowning in panic would say.
"Is there broccoli in these burgers?"
"A little," Dad said.
"Pretty exciting that you might go to Amsterdam."
"Yeah," I said. I tried not to think about the word wounded, which of course is a way of thinking about it. "Hazel," Mom said.
"Where are you right now?"
"Just thinking, I guess," I said.
"Twitter-pated," my dad said, smiling.
"I am not a bunny, and I am not in love with Gus Waters or anyone," I answered, way too defensively. Wounded. Like Caroline Mathers had been a bomb, and when she blew up, everyone around her was left with embedded shrapnel. Dad asked me if I was working on anything for school. "I've got some very advanced algebra homework," I told him. "So advanced that I couldn't possibly explain it to a layperson."
"And how's your friend Isaac?"
"Blind," I said.
"You're being very teenagery today," Mom said. She seemed annoyed about it.
"Isn't this what you wanted, Mom, for me to be teenagery?"
"Well, not necessarily this kind of teenagery, but of course your father and I are excited to see you become a young woman, making friends, going on dates."
"I'm not going on dates," I said. "I don't want to go on dates with anyone. It's a terrible idea and a huge waste of time and..."
"Honey," my mom said.
"What's wrong?" "I'm like a grenade, Mom. I'm a grenade, and at some point I'm going to blow up, and I would like to minimize the casualties, okay?"
My dad tilted his head a little to the side, like a scolded puppy.
"I'm a grenade," I said again. "I just want to stay away from people and read books and think and be with you guys because there's nothing I can do about hurting you. You're too invested, so please just let me do that, okay? I'm not depressed, I don't need to get out more, and I can't be a regular teenager because I'm a grenade."
"Hazel," Dad said, and then choked up. He cried a lot, my dad.
"I'm going to go to my room and read for a while, okay? I'm fine. I really am fine. I just want to go read for a while."
I started out trying to read this novel I'd been assigned, but we lived in a tragically thin-walled home, so I could hear much of the whispered conversation that ensued. My dad saying, "It kills me," and my mom saying, "That's exactly what she doesn't need to hear," and my dad saying, "I'm sorry, but," and my mom saying, "Are you not grateful?" and him saying, "God, of course I'm grateful." I kept trying to get into this story, but I couldn't stop hearing them. So I turned on my computer to listen to some music, and with Augustus's favorite band, The Hectic Glow, as my soundtrack, I went back to Caroline Mather's tribute pages, reading about how heroic her fight was, and how much she was missed, and how she was in a better place, and how she would live forever in their memories, and how everyone who knew her, everyone, was laid low by her leaving. Maybe I was supposed to hate Caroline Mathers or something because she'd been with Augustus, but I didn't. I couldn't see her very clearly amid all the tributes, but there didn't seem to be much to hate. She seemed to be mostly a professional sick person, like me, which made me worry that when I died they'd have nothing to say about me except that I fought heroically, as if the only thing I'd ever done was have cancer. Anyway, eventually I started reading Caroline Mather's little notes, which were mostly actually written by her parents because I guess her brain cancer was of the variety that makes you not you before it makes you not alive. So it was all like, Caroline continues to have behavioral problems. She's struggling a lot with anger and frustration over not being able to speak. We are frustrated about these things too, of course, but we have more socially acceptable ways of dealing with our anger. Gus has taken to calling Caroline Hulk Smash, which resonates with the doctors. There's nothing easy about this for any of us, but you take your humor where you can get it. Hoping to go home on Thursday. We'll let you know. She didn't go home on Thursday, needless to say. So of course I tensed up when he touched me. To be with him was to hurt him, inevitably. And that's what I'd felt as he reached for me. I'd felt as though I were committing an act of violence against him, because I was. I decided to text him. I wanted to avoid a whole conversation about it. Hi, so, okay. I don't know if you'll understand this, but I can't kiss you or anything. Not that you'd necessarily want to, but I can't. When I try to look at you like that, all I see is what I'm going to put you through. Maybe that doesn't make sense to you. Anyway, sorry. He responded a few minutes later. Okay. I wrote back. Okay. He responded, oh my God, stop flirting with me. I just said, okay. My phone buzzed moments later. I was kidding, Hazel Grace. I understand. But we both know that okay is a very flirty word. Okay is bursting with sensuality. I was very tempted to respond okay again, but I pictured him at my funeral, and that helped me text properly. Sorry. I tried to go to sleep with my headphones still on, but then after a while my mom and dad came in, and my mom grabbed Bluey from the shelf and hugged him to her stomach, and my dad sat down in my desk chair, and without crying he said, "You are not a grenade. Not to us. Thinking about you dying makes us sad, Hazel. But you are not a grenade. You are amazing. You can't know, sweetie. Because you've never had a baby become a brilliant young reader with a side interest in horrible television shows, but the joy you bring us is so much greater than the sadness we feel about your illness." "Okay," I said. "Really," my dad said. "I wouldn't bullshit you about this. If you were more trouble than you're worth, we'd just toss you out on the streets." "We're not sentimental people," Mom added, deadpan. "We'd leave you at an orphanage with a note pinned to your pajamas." I laughed. "You don't have to go to support group," Mom added. "You don't have to do anything, except go to school." She handed me the bear. "I think Bluey can sleep on the shelf tonight," I said. "Let me remind you that I am more than 33 half years old." "Keep him tonight," she said. "Mom," I said. "He's lonely," she said. "Oh my God, Mom," I said. But I took stupid Bluey and kind of cuddled with him as I fell asleep. I still had one arm draped over Bluey, in fact, when I awoke just after 4 in the morning with an apocalyptic pain fingering out from the unreachable center of my head. Chapter 7. I screamed to wake up my parents, and they burst into the room, but there was nothing they could do to dim the supernovae exploding inside my brain. An endless chain of intracranial firecrackers that made me think that I was once and for all going, and I told myself, as I've told myself before, that the body shuts down when the pain gets too bad, that consciousness is temporary, that this will pass. But just like always, I didn't slip away. I was left on the shore with the waves washing over me, unable to drown. Dad drove, talking on the phone with the hospital, while I lay in the back with my head in Mom's lap. There was nothing to do. Screaming made it worse. All stimuli made it worse, actually. The only solution was to try to unmake the world, to make it black and silent and uninhabited again, to return to the moment before the Big Bang, in the beginning when there was the Word, and to live in that vacuous, uncreated space alone with the Word. People talk about the courage of cancer patients, and I do not deny that courage. I had been poked and stabbed and poisoned for years, and still I trod on. But make no mistake, in that moment, I would have been very, very happy to die. I woke up in the ICU. I could tell I was in the ICU because I didn't have my own room, and because there was so much beeping, and because I was alone. They don't let your family stay with you 24/7 in the ICU at Children's because it's an infection risk. There was wailing down the hall. Somebody's kid had died. I was alone. I hit the red call button. A nurse came in seconds later. "Hi," I said. "Hello, Hazel. I'm Allison, your nurse," she said. "Hi, Allison, my nurse," I said. Whereupon I started to feel pretty tired again. But I woke up a bit when my parents came in, crying and kissing my face repeatedly, and I reached up for them and tried to squeeze, but my everything hurt when I squeezed, and Mom and Dad told me that I did not have a brain tumor, but that my headache was caused by poor oxygenation, which was caused by my lungs swimming in fluid, a liter and a half of which had been successfully drained from my chest, which was why I might feel a slight discomfort in my side where there was, hey, look at that, a tube that went from my chest into a plastic bladder half full of liquid that for all the world resembled my dad's favorite amber ale. Mom told me I was going to go home, that I really was, that I would just have to get this drained every now and again and get back on the BiPAP, this nighttime machine that forces air in and out of my crap lungs. But I'd had a total body PET scan on the first night in the hospital, they told me, and the news was good. No tumor growth. No new tumors. My shoulder pain had been lack of oxygen pain, heart working too hard pain. "Dr. Maria said this morning that she remains optimistic," Dad said. I liked Dr. Maria, and she didn't bullshit you, so that felt good to hear. "This is just a thing, Hazel," my mom said. "It's a thing we can live with." I nodded, and then Allison, my nurse, kind of politely made them leave. She asked me if I wanted some ice chips, and I nodded, and then she sat at the bed with me and spooned them into my mouth. "So, you've been gone a couple days," Allison said. "What did you miss?" "A celebrity did drugs. Politicians disagreed. A different celebrity wore a bikini that revealed a bodily imperfection. A team won a sporting event, but another team lost." I smiled. "You can't go disappearing on everybody like this, Hazel. You miss too much." "More?" I asked, nodding toward the white styrofoam cup in her hand. "I shouldn't," she said, "but I'm a rebel." She gave me another plastic spoonful of crushed ice. I mumbled a thank you. Praise God for good nurses. "Getting tired?" she asked. I nodded. "Sleep for a while," she said. "I'll try to run interference and give you a couple hours before somebody comes in to check vitals and the like." I said thanks again. You say thanks a lot in a hospital. I tried to settle into the bed. "You're not going to ask about your boyfriend?" she asked. "Don't have one," I told her. "Well, there's a kid who has hardly left the waiting room since you got here," she said. "He hasn't seen me like this, has he?" "Nope, family only." I nodded and sank into an aqueous sleep. It would take me 6 days to get home. 6 undays of staring at acoustic ceiling tile and watching television and sleeping and pain and wishing for time to pass. I did not see Augustus or anyone other than my parents. My hair looked like a bird's nest, my shuffling gait like a dementia patient's. I felt a little better each day, though. Each sleep ended to reveal a person who seemed a bit more like me. Sleep fights cancer, regular Dr. Jim said for the 1,000th time as he hovered over me one morning surrounded by a coterie of medical students. Then I am a cancer-fighting machine, I told him.
That you are, Hazel. Keep resting, and hopefully we'll get you home soon.
On Tuesday, they told me I'd go home on Wednesday. On Wednesday, two minimally supervised medical students removed my chest tube, which felt like getting stabbed in reverse and generally didn't go very well, so they decided I'd have to stay until Thursday. I was beginning to think that I was the subject of some existentialist experiment in permanently delayed gratification when Dr. Maria showed up on Friday morning, sniffed around me for a minute, and told me I was good to go. So Mom opened her oversized purse to reveal that she'd had my go-home clothes with her all along. A nurse came in and took out my IV. I felt untethered, even though I still had the oxygen tank to carry around with me. I went into the bathroom, took my first shower in a week, got dressed, and when I got out, I was so tired I had to lie down and get my breath. Mom asked, "Do you want to see Augustus?" "I guess," I said after a minute. I stood up and shuffled over to one of the molded plastic chairs against the wall, tucking my tank beneath the chair. It wore me out. Dad came back with Augustus a few minutes later. His hair was messy, sweeping down over his forehead. He lit up with a real Augustus Waters goofy smile when he saw me, and I couldn't help but smile back. He sat down in the blue faux leather recliner next to my chair. He leaned in toward me, seemingly incapable of stifling the smile. Mom and Dad left us alone, which felt awkward. I worked hard to meet his eyes, even though they were the kind of pretty that's hard to look at. "I missed you," Augustus said. My voice was smaller than I wanted it to be. "Thanks for not trying to see me when I looked like hell."
"To be fair, you still look pretty bad."
I laughed. "I missed you too. I just don't want you to see all this. I just want, like, it doesn't matter. You don't always get what you want."
"Is that so?" he asked. "I'd always thought the world was a wish-granting factory."
"Turns out that is not the case," I said. He was so beautiful. He reached for my hand, but I shook my head. "No," I said quietly. "If we're gonna hang out, it has to be, like, not that."
"Okay," he said. "Well, I have good news and bad news on the wish-granting front."
"Okay," I said.
"The bad news is that we obviously can't go to Amsterdam until you're better. The genies will, however, work their famous magic when you're well enough."
"That's the good news?"
"No, the good news is that while you were sleeping, Peter Van Houten shared a bit more of his brilliant brain with us."
He reached for my hand again, but this time to slip into it a heavily folded sheet of stationery on the letterhead of Peter Van Houten, Novelist Emeritus. I didn't read it until I got home, situated in my own huge and empty bed with no chance of medical interruption. It took me forever to decode Van Houten's sloped, scratchy script.
"Dear Mr. Waters, I am in receipt of your electronic mail dated the 14th of April and duly impressed by the Shakespearean complexity of your tragedy. Everyone in this tale has a rock-solid hamartia. Hers, that she is so sick. Yours, that you are so well. Were she better or you sicker, then the stars would not be so terribly crossed. But it is the nature of stars to cross. And never was Shakespeare more wrong than when he had Cassius note, 'The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves.' Easy enough to say when you're a Roman nobleman, or Shakespeare, but there is no shortage of fault to be found amid our stars. While we're on the topic of old Will's insufficiencies, your writing about young Hazel reminds me of the bard's 55th sonnet, which of course begins, 'Not marble, nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time.'
off topic, but what a slut Time is. She screws everybody. It's a fine poem, but a deceitful one. We do indeed remember Shakespeare's powerful rhyme, but what do we remember about the person it commemorates? Nothing. We're pretty sure he was male. Everything else is guesswork. Shakespeare told us precious little of the man whom he entombed in his linguistic sarcophagus. Witness also that when we talk about literature, we do so in the present tense. When we speak of the dead, we are not so kind. You do not immortalize the lost by writing about them. Language buries, but does not resurrect. Full disclosure, I am not the first to make this observation. C.F., the MacLeish poem, Not Marble Nor the Gilded Monuments, which contains the heroic line, I shall say you will die and none will remember you. I digress, but here's the rub. The dead are visible only in the terrible lidless eye of memory. The living, thank heaven, retain the ability to surprise and to disappoint. Your Hazel is alive, Waters. And you mustn't impose your will upon another's decision, particularly a decision arrived at thoughtfully. She wishes to spare you pain, and you should let her. You may not find young Hazel's logic persuasive, but I have trod through this vale of tears longer than you, and from where I'm sitting, she's not the lunatic. Yours truly, Peter Van Outen.
It was really written by him. I licked my finger and dabbed the paper, and the ink bled a little, so I knew it was really real. Mom, I said. I did not say it loudly, but I didn't have to. She was always waiting. She peeked her head around the door. You okay, sweetie? Can we call Dr. Maria and ask if international travel would kill me?
Chapter 8. We had a big cancer team meeting a couple days later. Every so often, a bunch of doctors and social workers and physical therapists and whoever else got together around a big table in a conference room and discussed my situation. Not the Augustus Waters situation or the Amsterdam situation, the cancer situation. Dr. Maria led the meeting. She hugged me when I got there. She was a hugger. I felt a little better, I guess. Sleeping with the BiPAP all night made my lungs feel almost normal, although, then again, I did not really remember lung normality. Everyone got there and made a big show of turning off their pagers and everything, so it would be all about me. And then Dr. Maria said, So the great news is that phalanxivore continues to control your tumor growth, but obviously we're still seeing serious problems with fluid accumulation. So the question is, how should we proceed? And then she just looked at me, like she was waiting for an answer. I said, I feel like I am not the most qualified person in the room to answer that question. She smiled. Right. I was waiting for Dr. Simons. Dr. Simons? He was another cancer doctor of some kind. Well, we know from other patients that most tumors eventually evolve a way to grow in spite of phalanxivore, but if that were the case, we'd see tumor growth on the scans, which we don't see. So it's not that yet.
Yet, I thought.
Dr. Simons tapped at the table with his forefinger.
The thought around here is that it's possible the phalanxivore is worsening the edema, but we'd face far more serious problems if we discontinued its use.
Dr. Maria added,
We don't really understand the long-term effects of phalanxivore. Very few people have been on it as long as you have.
So we're gonna do nothing?
We're going to stay the course, Dr. Maria said. But we'll need to do more to keep that edema from building up.
I felt kind of sick for some reason, like I was going to throw up. I hated cancer team meetings in general, but I hated this one in particular.
Your cancer is not going away, Hazel. But we've seen people live with your level of tumor penetration for a long time.
I did not ask what constituted a long time. I'd made that mistake before.
I know that coming out of the ICU, it doesn't feel this way. But this fluid is, at least for the time being, manageable.
Can't I just get, like, a lung transplant or something? I asked. Dr. Maria's lips shrank into her mouth.
You would not be considered a strong candidate for a transplant, unfortunately, she said. I understood. No use wasting good lungs on a hopeless case. I nodded, trying not to look like that comment hurt me. My dad started crying a little. I didn't look over at him, but no one said anything for a long time, so his hiccuping cry was the only sound in the room. I hated hurting him. Most of the time, I could forget about it, but the inexorable truth is this. They might be glad to have me around, but I was the alpha and the omega of my parents' suffering. Just before the miracle, when I was in the ICU and it looked like I was going to die and Mom was telling me it was okay to let go, and I was trying to let go but my lungs kept searching for air, Mom sobbed something into Dad's chest that I wish I hadn't heard, and that I hope she never finds out that I did hear. She said, "I won't be a mom anymore." It gutted me pretty badly. I couldn't stop thinking about that during the whole cancer team meeting. I couldn't get it out of my head, how she sounded when she said that, like she would never be okay again, which probably she wouldn't. Anyway, eventually we decided to keep things the same, only with more frequent fluid drainings. At the end, I asked if I could travel to Amsterdam, and Dr. Simons actually and literally laughed. But then Dr. Maria said, "Why not?" And Simons said dubiously, "Why not?" And Dr. Maria said, "Yeah, I don't see why not. They've got oxygen on the planes, after all." Dr. Simons said, "Are they just going to gate check BiPAP?" And Maria said, "Yeah, or have one waiting for her." Placing a patient, one of the most promising phalanxophore survivors, no less, on an 8-hour flight from the only physicians intimately familiar with her case. That's a recipe for disaster. Dr. Maria shrugged. "It would increase some risks," she acknowledged, but then she turned to me and said, "But it's your life." Except not really. On the car ride home, my parents agreed. I would not be going to Amsterdam unless and until there was medical agreement that it would be safe. Augustus called that night after dinner. I was already in bed, after dinner had become my bedtime for the moment, propped up with a gajillion pillows and also Bluey, with my computer on my lap. I picked up, saying, "Bad news," and he said, "Shit, what?" "I can't go to Amsterdam. One of my doctors thinks it's a bad idea." He was quiet for a second. "God," he said, "I should have just paid for it myself. Should have just taken you straight from the funky bones to Amsterdam." But then I would have had a probably fatal episode of deoxygenation in Amsterdam, and my body would have been shipped home in the cargo hold of an airplane, I said. "Well, yeah," he said, "but before that, my grand romantic gesture would have totally gotten me laid." I laughed pretty hard, hard enough that I felt where the chest tube had been. "You laugh because it's true," he said. I laughed again. "It's true, isn't it?" "Probably not," I said, and then after a moment added, "although you never know." He moaned in misery. "I'm gonna die a virgin," he said. "You're a virgin?" I asked, surprised. "Hazel Grace," he said. "Do you have a pen and a piece of paper?" I said I did. "Okay, please draw a circle." I did. "Now draw a smaller circle within that circle." I did. "The larger circle is virgins. The smaller circle is 17-year-old guys with one leg." I laughed again and told him that having most of your social engagements occur at a children's hospital also did not encourage promiscuity. And then we talked about Peter Van Houten's amazingly brilliant comment about the sluttiness of time. And even though I was in bed and he was in his basement, it really felt like we were back in that uncreated third space, which was a place I really liked visiting with him. Then I got off the phone and my mom and dad came into my room. And even though it was really not big enough for all three of us, they lay on either side of the bed with me and we all watched ANTM on the little TV in my room. This girl I didn't like, Selena, got kicked off, which made me really happy for some reason. Then Mom hooked me up to the BiPAP and tucked me in, and Dad kissed me on the forehead, the kiss all stubble. And then I closed my eyes. The BiPAP essentially took control of my breathing away from me, which was intensely annoying. But the great thing about it was that it made all this noise, rumbling with each inhalation and whirring as I exhaled. I kept thinking that it sounded like a dragon breathing in time with me, like I had this pet dragon who was cuddled up next to me and cared enough about me to time his breaths to mine. I was thinking about that as I sank into sleep. I got up late the next morning. I watched TV in bed and checked my email, and then after a while started crafting an email to Peter Van Houten about how I couldn't come to Amsterdam, but I swore upon the life of my mother that I would never share any information about the characters with anyone, that I didn't even want to share it, because I was a terribly selfish person, and could he please just tell me if the Dutch Tulip Man is for real and if Anna's mom marries him, and also about Sisyphus the hamster. But I didn't send it. It was too pathetic, even for me. Around 3, when I figured Augustus would be home from school, I went into the backyard and called him. As the phone rang, I sat down on the grass, which was all overgrown and dandelion-y. That swing set was still back there, weeds growing out of the little ditch I'd created from kicking myself higher as a little kid. I remembered Dad bringing home the kit from Toys R Us and building it in the backyard with a neighbor. He'd insisted on swinging on it first to test it, and the thing damn near broke. The sky was gray and low and full of rain, but not yet raining. I hung up when I got Augustus's voicemail and then put the phone down in the dirt beside me and kept looking at the swing set, thinking that I would give up all the sick days I had left for a few healthy ones. I tried to tell myself that it could be worse, that the world was not a wish-granting factory, that I was living with cancer, not dying of it, that I mustn't let it kill me before it kills me. And then I just started muttering, stupid, 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 over and over again until the sound unhinged from its meaning. I was still saying it when he called back.
Hi,
I said.
Hazel Grace, he said.
Hi,
I said again.
Are you crying, Hazel Grace?
Kind of.
Why?
He asked.
Because I'm just... I want to go to Amsterdam, and I want him to tell me what happens after the book is over. And I just don't want my particular life. And also, the sky is depressing me, and there is this old swing set out here that my dad made for me when I was a kid.
I must see this old swing set of tears immediately, he said. I'll be over in 20 minutes.
I stayed in the backyard because Mom was always really smothery and concerned when I was crying, because I did not cry often. And I knew she'd want to talk and discuss whether I shouldn't consider adjusting my medication, and the thought of that whole conversation made me want to throw up. It's not like I had some utterly poignant, well-lit memory of a healthy father pushing a healthy child and the child saying, "Higher, higher, higher," or some other metaphorically resonant moment. The swing set was just sitting there, abandoned. The two little swings hanging still and sad from a grayed plank of wood. The outline of the seats like a kid's drawing of a smile. Behind me, I heard the sliding glass door open. I turned around. It was Augustus, wearing khaki pants and a short-sleeve plaid button-down. I wiped my face with my sleeve and smiled.
"Hi,"
I said. It took him a second to sit down on the ground next to me, and he grimaced as he landed rather ungracefully on his ass.
"Hi,"
he said finally. I looked over at him. He was looking past me into the backyard.
"I see your point," he said as he put an arm around my shoulder. "That is one sad goddamn swing set."
I nudged my head into his shoulder.
"Thanks for offering to come over."
"You realize that trying to keep your distance from me will not lessen my affection for you," he said.
"I guess," I said.
"All efforts to save me from you will fail," he said.
"Why? Why would you even like me? Haven't you put yourself through enough of this?"
I asked, thinking of Caroline Mathers. Gus didn't answer. He just held on to me, his fingers strong against my left arm.
"We gotta do something about this frigging swing set," he said. "I'm telling you, it's 90% of the problem."
Once I'd recovered, we went inside and sat down on the couch right next to each other, the laptop half on his, fake, knee, and half on mine. "Hot," I said of the laptop's base.
Is it now?
He smiled. Gus loaded this giveaway site called Free No Catch, and together we wrote an ad.
Headline? He asked.
Swing set needs home, I said.
Desperately lonely swing set needs loving home, he said.
Lonely, vaguely pedophilic swing set seeks the butts of children, I said.
He laughed. That's why.
What?
That's why I like you. Do you realize how rare it is to come across a hot girl who creates an adjectival version of the word pedophile? You're so busy being you that you have no idea how utterly unprecedented you are.
I took a deep breath through my nose. There was never enough air in the world, but the shortage was particularly acute in that moment. We wrote the ad together, editing each other as we went. In the end, we settled upon this. Desperately lonely swing set needs loving home. One swing set, well-worn but structurally sound, seeks new home. Make memories with your kid or kids so that someday he or she or they will look into the backyard and feel the ache of sentimentality as desperately as I did this afternoon. It's all fragile and fleeting, dear reader, but with this swing set, your child or children will be introduced to the ups and downs of human life gently and safely, and may also learn the most important lesson of all. No matter how hard you kick, no matter how high you get, you can't go all the way around. Swing set currently resides near 83rd and Spring Mill. After that, we turned on the TV for a little while. But we couldn't find anything to watch, so I grabbed an Imperial Affliction off the bedside table and brought it back into the living room, and Augustus Waters read to me while Mom, making lunch, listened in. Mother's glass eye turned inward, Augustus began. As he read, I fell in love the way you fall asleep, slowly and then all at once. When I checked my email an hour later, I learned that we had plenty of swing set suitors to choose from. In the end, we picked a guy named Daniel Alvarez who'd included a picture of his three kids playing video games with the subject line, I just want them to go outside. I emailed him back and told him to pick it up at his leisure. Augustus asked if I wanted to go with him to support group, but I was really tired from my busy day of having cancer, so I passed. We were sitting there on the couch together, and he pushed himself up to go, but then fell back down onto the couch and sneaked a kiss onto my cheek. Augustus, I said.
Friendly, he said.
He pushed himself up again and really stood this time, then took two steps over to my mom and said, always a pleasure to see you. And my mom opened her arms to hug him, whereupon Augustus leaned in and kissed my mom on the cheek. He turned back to me.
See?
He asked. I went to bed right after dinner, the BiPAP drowning out the world beyond my room. I never saw the swing set again. I slept for a long time, 10 hours, possibly because of the slow recovery and possibly because sleep fights cancer and possibly because I was a teenager with no particular wake-up time. I wasn't strong enough yet to go back to classes at MCC. When I finally felt like getting up, I removed the BiPAP snout from my nose, put my oxygen nubbins in, turned them on, and then grabbed my laptop from beneath my bed, where I'd stashed it the night before. I had an email from Litowidge Vliegenthart. Dear Hazel, I have received word via the genies that you will be visiting us with Augustus Waters and your mother beginning on 3rd of May. Only a week away. Peter and I are delighted and cannot wait to make your acquaintance. Your hotel, the Philosophe, is just one street away from Peter's home. Perhaps we should give you one day for the jet lag, yes? So if convenient, we will meet you at Peter's home on the morning of 4th May at perhaps 10 o'clock for a cup of coffee and for him to answer questions you have about his book. And then perhaps afterward we can tour a museum or the Anne Frank House. With all best wishes, Litowidge Vliegenthart. Executive Assistant to Mr. Peter Van Outen, author of An Imperial Affliction. Mom, I said. She didn't answer.
Mom!
I shouted.
Nothing.
Again, louder. Mom!
She ran in wearing a threadbare pink towel under her armpits, dripping, vaguely panicked.
What's wrong?
Nothing. Sorry, I didn't know you were in the shower, I said.
Bath, she said.
I was just... She closed her eyes. Just trying to take a bath for 5 seconds. Sorry, what's going on? Can you call the genies and tell them the trip is off? I just got an email from Peter Van Houten's assistant. She thinks we're coming.
She pursed her lips and squinted past me.
What? I asked.
I'm not supposed to tell you until your father gets home.
What?
I asked again.
Trip's on, she said finally. Dr. Maria called us last night and made a convincing case that you need to live your...
Mom, I love you so much!
I shouted, and she came to the bed and let me hug her. I texted Augustus because I knew he was in school.
Still free, May 3?
Smiley face. He texted back immediately.
Everything's coming up waters.
If I could just stay alive for a week, I'd know the unwritten secrets of Anna's mom and a Dutch tulip guy. I looked down my blouse at my chest.
Keep your shit together,
I whispered to my lungs. Chapter 9. The day before we left for Amsterdam, I went back to support group for the first time since meeting Augustus. The cast had rotated a bit down there in the literal heart of Jesus. I arrived early, enough time for perennially strong appendiceal cancer survivor Lida to bring me up to date on everyone as I ate a grocery store chocolate chip cookie while leaning against the dessert table. 12-year-old leukemic Michael had passed away. He'd fought hard, Lida told me, as if there were another way to fight. Everyone else was still around. Ken was NEC after radiation. Lucas had relapsed, and she said it with a sad smile and a little shrug, the way you might say an alcoholic had relapsed. A cute, chubby girl walked over to the table and said hi to Lida, then introduced herself to me as Susan. I didn't know what was wrong with her, but she had a scar extending from the side of her nose down her lip and across her cheek. She had put makeup over the scar, which only served to emphasize it. I was feeling a little out of breath from all the standing, so I said, I'm gonna go sit. And then the elevator opened, revealing Isaac and his mom. He wore sunglasses and clung to his mom's arm with one hand, a cane in the other. Support group Hazelnut Monica, I said when he got close enough, and he smiled and said, Hey Hazel, how's it going?
Good. I've gotten really hot since you went blind.
I bet, he said.
His mom led him to a chair, kissed the top of his head, and shuffled back toward the elevator. He felt around beneath him and then sat. I sat down in the chair next to him.
So how's it going?
Okay. Glad to be home, I guess. Gus told me you were in the ICU.
Yeah, I said.
Sucks, he said.
I'm a lot better now, I said. I'm going to Amsterdam tomorrow with Gus.
I know. I'm pretty well up to date on your life because Gus never talks about anything else.
I smiled. Patrick cleared his throat and said,
If we could all take a seat.
He caught my eye.
Hazel, he said, I'm so glad to see you.
Everyone sat and Patrick began his retelling of his ballessness, and I fell into the routine of support group, communicating through sighs with Isaac, feeling sorry for everyone in the room and also everyone outside of it, zoning out of the conversation to focus on my breathlessness and the aching. The world went on, as it does, without my full participation, and I only woke up from the reverie when someone said my name. It was Lida the Strong, Lida in remission, blonde, healthy, stout Lida, who swam on her high school swim team, Lida missing only her appendix, saying my name, saying, Hazel is such an inspiration to me. She really is. She just keeps fighting the battle, waking up every morning and going to war without complaint. She's so strong. She's so much stronger than I am. I just wish I had her strength.
Hazel? Patrick asked. How does that make you feel?
I shrugged and looked over at Lida.
I'll give you my strength if I can have your remission.
I felt guilty as soon as I said it.
I don't think that's what Lida meant, Patrick said. I think she...
But I'd stopped listening.
After the prayers for the living and the endless litany of the dead, with Michael tacked on to the end, we held hands and said, "Living our best life today." Lida immediately rushed up to me full of apology and explanation, and I said, "No, no, it's really fine," waving her off, and I said to Isaac, "Care to accompany me upstairs?" He took my arm, and I walked with him to the elevator, grateful to have an excuse to avoid the stairs. I'd almost made it all the way to the elevator when I saw his mom standing in a corner of the literal heart. "I'm here," she said to Isaac, and he switched from my arm to hers before asking, "You want to come over?" "Sure," I said. I felt bad for him. Even though I hated the sympathy people felt toward me, I couldn't help but feel it toward him. Isaac lived in a small ranch house in Meridian Hills next to this fancy private school. We sat down in the living room while his mom went off to the kitchen to make dinner, and then he asked if I wanted to play a game. "Sure," I said. So he asked for the remote. I gave it to him, and he turned on the TV and then a computer attached to it. The TV screen stayed black, but after a few seconds a deep voice spoke from it.
"Deception," the voice said. "One player or two?"
"Two," Isaac said. "Pause." He turned to me. "I play this game with Gus all the time, but it's infuriating because he is a completely suicidal video game player. He's, like, way too aggressive about saving civilians and whatnot."
"Yeah," I said, remembering the night of the broken trophies.
"Unpause," Isaac said.
"Player one, identify yourself."
"This is player one's sexy, sexy voice," Isaac said.
"Player two, identify yourself."
"I would be player two, I guess," I said.
"Staff Sergeant Max Mayhem and Private Jasper Jax awake in a dark, empty room, approximately 12 feet square."
Isaac pointed toward the TV, like I should talk to it or something. I said. "Is there a light switch?"
"No."
"Is there a door?"
"Private Jax locates the door. It is locked."
Isaac jumped in. "There's a key above the door frame."
"Yes, there is."
"Mayhem opens the door."
"The darkness is still complete."
"Take out knife," Isaac said. "Take out knife," I added. A kid, Isaac's brother, I assume, darted out from the kitchen. He was maybe 10, wiry and over-energetic, and he kind of skipped across the living room before shouting in a really good imitation of Isaac's voice, "Kill myself!"
Sergeant Mayhem places his knife to his neck. "Are you sure you..."
"No," Isaac said. "Pause. Graham, don't make me kick your ass." Graham laughed giddily and skipped off down a hallway. As Mayhem and Jax, Isaac and I felt our way forward in the cavern until we bumped into a guy whom we stabbed after getting him to tell us that we were in a Ukrainian prison cave, more than a mile beneath the ground. As we continued, sound effects, a raging underground river, voices speaking in Ukrainian and accented English, led you through the cave, but there was nothing to see in this game. After playing for an hour, we began to hear the cries of a desperate prisoner pleading,
"God help me! God help me!"
"Pause," Isaac said. "This is when Gus always insists on finding the prisoner, even though that keeps you from winning the game, and the only way to actually free the prisoner is to win the game." "Yeah, he takes video games too seriously," I said. "He's a bit too enamored with metaphor." "Do you like him?" Isaac asked. "Of course I like him. He's great." "But you don't want to hook up with him?" I shrugged. "It's complicated." "I know what you're trying to do. You don't want to give him something he can't handle. You don't want him to Monica you," he said. "Kinda," I said. But it wasn't that. The truth was, I didn't want to Isaac him. "To be fair to Monica," I said, "what you did to her wasn't very nice either."
"What did I do to her?"
he asked, defensive. "You know, going blind and everything."
"But that's not my fault," Isaac said.
"I'm not saying it was your fault. I'm saying it wasn't nice." Chapter 10. We could only take one suitcase. I couldn't carry one, and Mom insisted that she couldn't carry two. so we had to jockey for space in this black suitcase my parents had gotten as a wedding present a million years ago. A suitcase that was supposed to spend its life in exotic locales, but ended up mostly going back and forth to Dayton, where Morris Property Inc. had a satellite office that Dad often visited. I argued with Mom that I should have slightly more than half of the suitcase, since without me and my cancer, we'd never be going to Amsterdam in the first place. Mom countered that since she was twice as large as me and therefore required more physical fabric to preserve her modesty, she deserved at least 2/3 of the suitcase. In the end, we both lost. So it goes. Our flight didn't leave until noon, but Mom woke me up at 5:30, turning on the light and shouting, "Amsterdam!" She ran around all morning making sure we had international plug adapters and quadruple checking that we had the right number of oxygen tanks to get there and that they were all full, etc., while I just rolled out of bed, put on my travel to Amsterdam outfit, jeans, a pink tank top, and a black cardigan in case the plane was cold. The car was packed by 6:15, whereupon Mom insisted that we eat breakfast with Dad, although I had a moral opposition to eating before dawn on the grounds that I was not a 19th-century Russian peasant fortifying myself for a day in the fields. But anyway, I tried to stomach down some eggs while Mom and Dad enjoyed these homemade versions of Egg McMuffins they liked. "Why are breakfast foods breakfast foods?" I asked them. "Like, why don't we have curry for breakfast?"
"Hazel, eat."
"But why?" I asked. "I mean, seriously, how did scrambled eggs get stuck with breakfast exclusivity? You can put bacon on a sandwich without anyone freaking out, but the moment your sandwich has an egg, boom, it's a breakfast sandwich." Dad answered with his mouth full.
"When you come back, we'll have breakfast for dinner. Deal?"
"I don't want to have breakfast for dinner," I answered, crossing knife and fork over my mostly full plate. "I want to have scrambled eggs for dinner without this ridiculous construction that a scrambled egg-inclusive meal is breakfast, even when it occurs at dinner time." "You've got to pick your battles in this world, Hazel," my mom said. "But if this is the issue you want to champion, we will stand behind you."
"Quite a bit behind you," my dad added, and Mom laughed.
Anyway, I knew it was stupid, but I felt kind of bad for scrambled eggs. After they finished eating, Dad did the dishes and walked us to the car. Of course, he started crying, and he kissed my cheek with his wet, stubbly face. He pressed his nose against my cheekbone and whispered,
"I love you. I'm so proud of you."
"For what?" I wondered. "Thanks, Dad."
"I'll see you in a few days, okay, sweetie? I love you so much."
"I love you too, Dad," I smiled. "And it's only 3 days." As we backed out of the driveway, I kept waving at him. He was waving back and crying. It occurred to me that he was probably thinking he might never see me again, which he probably thought every single morning of his entire weekday life as he left for work, which probably sucked. Mom and I drove over to Augustus's house, and when we got there, she wanted me to stay in the car to rest, but I went to the door with her anyway. As we approached the house, I could hear someone crying inside. I didn't think it was Gus at first, because it didn't sound anything like the low rumble of his speaking. But then I heard a voice that was definitely a twisted version of his say,
"Because it is my life, Mom! It belongs to me!"
And quickly my mom put her arm around my shoulders and spun me back toward the car, walking quickly. And I was like, "Mom, what's wrong?" And she said, "We can't eavesdrop, Hazel." We got back into the car, and I texted Augustus that we were outside whenever he was ready. We stared at the house for a while. The weird thing about houses is that they almost always look like nothing is happening inside of them, even though they contain most of our lives. I wondered if that was sort of the point of architecture. "Well," Mom said after a while, "we are pretty early, I guess." "Almost as if I didn't have to get up at 5:30, I said. Mom reached down to the console between us, grabbed her coffee mug, and took a sip. My phone buzzed. A text from Augustus.
"Just can't decide what to wear. Do you like me better in a polo or a button-down?"
I replied, "Button-down."
30 seconds later, the front door opened, and a smiling Augustus appeared, a roller bag behind him. He wore a pressed sky-blue button-down tucked into his jeans. A camel light dangled from his lips. My mom got out to say hi to him. He took the cigarette out momentarily and